today I would like to talk about setting limits and making a discovery. That is to say, from a statistical standpoint, convincing your readers, your colleagues, that the discovery you think you have made is significant, statistically significant. And I will do a couple of examples for both the frequentist and Bayesian approaches, so we can see somehow how they relate to each other. And in particular, if you have various sorts of systematic uncertainties and you would like to incorporate those uncertainties into whatever types of limits that you're setting or into whatever measure of discovery significance you're claiming, that becomes a non-trivial exercise. And so we'll talk about that as well. So here is the problem that I'm going to concentrate on for at least the first third of this lecture. And it has to do with setting limits in the simple case where your experiment consists of just counting a certain number of events, n events. And the idea is that I'm going to model n as a Poisson-distributed quantity. And the idea is that the number of events that I find can come from two different sources. I will have a certain number of background events, or there will be an expectation value B for the number of background events, and then I could have an expectation value S for the number of signal events. But of course, I don't measure those two numbers separately. I only measure the total number of events. That is to say, n will follow a Poisson distribution with a mean value s plus b. So that would be the probability law for n. That's the Poisson distribution. Now, normally, if you have b determined from some control experiment or from some Monte Carlo prediction, let me assume for the moment that B is known with negligible uncertainty. We'll get to the case in just a bit where there's an uncertainty in your estimate of the background. But for now, let's suppose that the expected number of background events is known exactly. And let's suppose that is 4.6, and you do your experiment and you find 5 events. And suppose the goal of the experiment is to try to establish whether or not the signal process exists at all. All right? But if you expected 4.6 background and you only observed 5 events, then the presence of signal is not statistically significant. And so what you would do, if that was the outcome of your experiment, is you would try to set some sort of limit, an upper limit, on the parameter S, on the expected number of signal events. And like I say, we will start by doing this assuming that B is known, and then proceed to the case where there's some uncertainty in B. So let's talk about setting limits in a general framework. The idea of setting a limit for the parameter S can be done by constructing a test for each value of S. So I'm going to talk about how to test an individual value of S, and then we'll simply repeat that exercise for all possible values of S. And the idea is the following, is that you specify values of the data, n, that are in some sense disfavored by s. And that is what's called the critical region of a test. And the way that you specify the critical region is that you specify that value of data space such that the probability to find a data outcome in that region should be less than or equal to a pre-specified constant, which is called the significance level of the test. Typically, that constant, what I've called here gamma, is chosen to be some small value, perhaps 5%, in other cases perhaps 10%, but that's a pre-specified constant. Now, you do the experiment, you observe a certain number of events, and if n is observed to fall in this critical region, then you reject the hypothesized value of s. And then you repeat that exercise for all values of s, and then you define what is called a confidence interval as the set of parameter values, the set of s values, which were not rejected in a test of size or significance level gamma. And you say that the confidence level of that confidence interval is 1 minus gamma. So if gamma was 5%, then the resulting set of not rejected s values, that would be a 95% confidence level, confidence interval for that parameter. Now, that was a bit complicated. There are other ways of viewing construction of confidence intervals. that I find even more complicated. But it's the kind of thing that I think you have to sit down with and think a bit about. This interval will cover the true value of S with a probability greater than or equal to the confidence interval. That is to say, you can imagine if you repeated the experiment many times and constructed a confidence interval for S each time, sometimes it would bracket the true value of S, and other times it would miss. And by the way that this interval has been constructed, it would actually cover the true value of the parameter with a probability at least equal to this confidence level. Okay, so those are confidence intervals. Okay, so now let's suppose what we are interested in doing is setting an upper limit on this parameter S. Right, and I'm going to assume in this round now that B is known. And so how do we define the critical region of this test? That is to say, what are the data values that are disfavored by the hypothesis of a certain value of S from the standpoint of setting an upper limit? Well, that would clearly be values of N, which are lower. That is to say, I want to say, do I think it's possible that S could be equal to 15 when I saw N equal to 10, perhaps? All right. Well, what values of N are even in greater disagreement with 15 than 10? Well, 9 or 8 or 7, you know, even fewer events. So what you need to do is you need to find, you set this probability to find S less than or equal to the number that you observed equal to this significance level of the test. And if that probability law is just the Poisson probability law, then that is simply the sum from n equals 0 up to the number n that you observed of the Poisson probability. Right? And so you solve that equation, gamma equals that thing for S, and that gives you your upper limit at the confidence level. So the interval then from 0 up to whatever that number is, that gives you your upper limit at a confidence level of 1 minus gamma. Normally solving that, I'll show on the next slide a trick for solving that equation, but you can do it very simply if, for example, the expected background happened to be 0, and suppose you observe 0, then you can, that's the sum from n equals 0 to 0, and everything simplifies very neatly. The only thing that survives is the e to the minus s term, right? And so gamma equals e to the minus s, which means that the upper limit on s is minus log gamma. And if gamma is 0.05, then that upper limit is around 3. It's 2.96 something. So that's kind of interesting. That means that if you look for some effect and you have essentially zero expected background, but you see zero, and then you ask yourself, what is the hypothetical value of the parameter S such that there would be a 5% probability to observe zero? The number's 3. So an example of that would be these proton decay experiments that looked at their big tank of protons for a year, say. They had a very low background, not exactly zero, but very close to zero. And suppose in a year you observe zero events, then the upper limit on the number of proton decays that could have taken place was 3. Okay? So now, in general, solving that equation that I wrote down is has to be done numerically, or you can use the following trick. That sum of Poisson probabilities can be related to what's called the quantile of the chi-square distribution. This capital F is the cumulative distribution for the chi-square distribution, and the inverse function is what's called the quantile. Anyway, these are functions that for which there exist computer routines in the root library and other computer libraries. And so I just wanted to somehow make the point that there are simple computer routines that allow you to solve that equation in one step. And those are the equations. And so here is a plot then of, say, the upper limit. I've called it here new S up, but this is just S up. It's the upper limit. As a function of the expected background for different numbers of the events that you would observe. And so the comment to make here is the following, is that the expressions for these limits, you end up subtracting the expected background, which is kind of what you would expect to do. But what that means is the following, is that suppose you have an expected background of, I don't know, 2 or something, and you observe, however, a smaller number of events. So the number of events that you observe is even less than the expectation of the background. That means that the upper limit can be very small, or even if you apply this recipe naively, the upper limit can go negative. Which, think about it, the mean value of a Poisson variable has to obviously be positive, and yet the recipe that we've derived says that the upper limit on that parameter is negative, which is a little bit ridiculous. So, here's the numerical example. Suppose B is 2.5, all right? It can easily happen that because of a statistical fluctuation that you don't observe that many or more. Suppose you only observe zero. And if you had chosen as your confidence level 90%, so 0.1 for gamma, then it turns out that the recipe that I had on the previous overhead gives negative 0.197 for the upper limit. And this is a bit of a frustrating situation for the physicist, because obviously you knew that S was positive even before you invested any money in building your expensive experiment. And so how would you feel to have to publish that as your result, as the outcome of all that effort, that what you know now is that with a certain probability, S is less than this negative number? Well, clearly, this is one of the 10% of the times when this interval does not cover the true value of the parameter. Right? Now, the statistician would say, nothing went wrong, that's fine. The interval is designed to cover the true value 90% of the time. And so clearly, you had a bit of bad luck, and you had one of those times when your confidence interval clearly doesn't cover the true value of the parameter. And this is not an uncommon dilemma. It will happen, you know, roughly 10% of the time. When you have a case where the limit of the parameter is close to a physical boundary, and it used to, there were a number of raging debates earlier on about the neutrino mass limits, for example, because there you would estimate the neutrino mass squared through sort of an energy squared minus a momentum squared. And so obviously, if you have statistical fluctuations on either of these quantities, you can easily come out with a negative limit for the neutrino mass squared. So what is the physicist to do in such a situation? You might say, well, all right, I had chosen that one convention of a 90% confidence level, confidence interval. That was perhaps not a good choice. Maybe I should have chosen 95% instead of 90%. If you look back at that formula, you see that if you had chosen 95%, then the upper limit would just get pushed positive, right? It would have gone just 0.496. It's like, great, all right, I didn't mean 90%. I should have done 95%. And you get a positive answer. And why stop there, right? If you had chosen as the confidence level 91.7923%, right, then it turns out that what's happening then is that you're just pushing the upper limit just above zero, and you would have an upper limit of about 10 to the minus 4. So it sounds like by contriving the confidence level to be a specific value, you're being able to set fantastically small upper limits on this parameter. Now clearly something is wrong here. Let's do a reality check. The expected number of background events was 2.5. Right? And this is a Poisson distributed quantity. Recall that the standard deviation of a Poisson distributed quantity is equal to the square root of its mean, right? So 1.6. Now, if your experiment is measuring a number of events and you expect the statistical fluctuation in the number of background events to be on the order of 1.6, then how in the world can you be setting an upper limit of 10 to the minus 4? So what's important, that is, it's not wrong technically, but it is not the only relevant piece of information. What would be necessary to report here is also the expected limit of the background-only hypothesis that you would get. So in other words, if you would assume that only background is present, and then simulate the experiment by generating values from a Poisson distribution. And in each experiment, you calculate, say, the 95% confidence level upper limit. Then here is the distribution that you would get. All right? And so sometimes you get zero events generated, and that would correspond to setting your limit here. All right? That's this 0.496, that contribution right there. But on the other hand, sometimes the Poisson distribution dishes up one event or two event or three events, and so you get this distribution here. And so really the relevant quantity to report together with your observed limit is the expected limit under the background-only hypothesis, which in this case happens to be 4.44. Okay. So I said that to construct a limit, what we do is we construct a test of the various parameter values, a test of S, and there is a certain amount of freedom in choosing how to do that test. And one of the ways of doing the test is based on what is called the likelihood ratio. And this was rediscovered for particle physics by Feldman and Cousins a number of years ago. And the idea is the following, is that we construct this quantity, which I've called here L of S, small L of S, the likelihood ratio. So in the numerator, I have the likelihood, which is the probability to find the data N given S and B. And in the denominator, I put the maximum of the likelihood ratio. So here, S hat is that value of S which maximizes the likelihood. So you can see that this ratio is somewhere between 0 and 1. Right? That if the hypothesized S is equal to the maximum likelihood estimator S hat, then the ratio is 1. On the other hand, if it's very far apart, then the ratio will become small. Now, you can see that this ratio itself is, in a sense, a measure of the level of agreement between the hypothesized S and the observed value of N. Right? If the two are in good agreement, that means that S hat will come out close to S, right? And the ratio will come out close to 1. Right? Otherwise, if this ratio comes out far away from 1, so that is to say close to 0, that means that the N and S are in disagreement. And you use that ratio as the basis of the test. That is to say, the rejection region of the test is defined by low values of the likelihood ratio, and you reject S if this probability is, if the probability to be in the critical region is less than the pre-specified significance level gamma. Right. So that, like I say, that was rediscovered for particle physics a number of years ago, but this has been known in the statistics literature for many decades as a standard procedure of inverting a likelihood ratio test to establish a confidence interval. Now, I'm not sure I want to go through all of this. I want to just make the point that the Feldman-Cousins intervals can either give you an upper limit, or they can give you a two-sided interval, depending on the value of n, which you observe in your experiment. Now, if the goal of the experiment is to, well, if what you want is to establish an upper limit, then it's not completely clear that this is the most appropriate procedure. In fact, in the procedures that we've been developing for the Atlas searches, in fact, we won't be using this exactly for that reason. But that's a level of technical detail that I think I don't need to get into now. We will, however, be using tests based on the likelihood ratio, which is why I wanted to introduce that. Okay, now up to now, I have assumed that the expected background is known exactly. That could be measured in an auxiliary experiment, or it could be based on a Monte Carlo simulation, but up to now I've assumed that that was exactly known. That doesn't mean that the actual number of background events will be the same for every experiment, but the expectation value, I said, was exactly known. Now, in fact, we don't even achieve that. The expected number of background events itself will have some uncertainty. Now, suppose what you have, instead of B, is some sort of a measurement from an auxiliary experiment, and it itself has some uncertainty. So I then have, as the outcome of my experiment, this value B measured and the eventual number N of events in my main experiment. So I've enlarged what I call the output of my experiment to include these two quantities. And now I have two parameters, the parameter S that I'm interested in, and the true value of B, which I don't know, but I have to treat that now as a nuisance parameter. Now, you can generalize this procedure for constructing confidence intervals to include more than one measured output and more than one parameter. And the idea is to construct an interval for the parameter of interest that will bracket the parameter of interest with a specified probability, regardless of the value, the true value, of the nuisance parameter. And that turns out to be very difficult. And I think on the original slide that I had, difficult and rarely attempted. But on the other hand, I found a couple of examples of people who have attempted to do this. But people tend not to go for a straightforward generalization of this confidence interval procedure in the case where you have nuisance parameters. But it turns out that there is An approximate procedure, which works almost as well and is much easier, and so that's what I want to explain. And that is based on what is called the profile likelihood. All right, so this is, has become a very fashionable technique in the last couple of years, so I think it's important that we go over this. Okay, now suppose, just in general, that I have a model for some data, which I'll call X here, right? And the model contains a parameter of interest mu and a nuisance parameter nu. Right? Actually, these could, of course, be sets of parameters. So mu could be a vector of parameters of interest, and nu could be a vector of nuisance parameters. Okay. So I then define the profile likelihood ratio according to this formula here. So let's look at this carefully. What I'm doing is I'm going to test a specified value of the parameter of interest, mu. In the numerator of the likelihood ratio, I have the likelihood for mu, and then for the nuisance parameters, I put that value, which maximizes the likelihood, for the specified value of mu. And that's what's written nu double hat. All right? The double hat prescription means that you choose that value of the parameter, which maximizes the likelihood, conditional upon the specified value of mu. So nu double hat is a function of mu. In the denominator, what I have is the values of the parameters that maximize the likelihood, right, unconditionally. And that is, so the thing in the numerator is called the profile likelihood function, and that ratio is what we usually refer to just as the profile likelihood ratio, but it's the numerator that contains the profile likelihood. And again, just as in the previous case when I was discussing the case with no nuisance parameters, this ratio reflects the level of agreement between the data and the hypothesized value of the parameter of interest. Okay. Ratio close to 1, good agreement. Ratio close to 0, poor agreement. Now, equivalently, what we usually work with is minus 2 times the log of this ratio, minus 2 times log lambda, and I call that here Q sub mu. And it turns out the Q sub mu behaves kind of like a chi-squared, the well-known chi-squared goodness of fit type variable, in that a small value of Q mu indicates that lambda was close to 1. So that indicates good agreement between the data and the hypothesized mu, whereas a large value of Q mu indicates lambda close to 0. So that's like getting a large chi-squared, poor chi-squared.
Yeah.
Right. It was kind of like what I said with the previous ratio, but let me say it again here. Suppose the data are in good agreement with the hypothesized value of mu. Okay? Suppose they are. Then what are you going to get from mu hat? Well, that means mu hat is going to come out close to mu. All right? And so that means that the numerator and denominator are going to be the same in that case. All right? So therefore, the ratio would come out close to 1. Yeah. Yeah, and the upper one, it works too.
It's a function of mu.
But the point is that, okay, but it's going to be similar. So suppose mu hat comes out equal to mu, all right? That means that the nu hat will be the value of nu, which maximizes L when mu hat is equal to mu, because I'm saying suppose mu hat comes out equal to mu. And then in the numerator, you also have nu double hat of mu, right? So if mu hat comes out equal to mu, then the ratio is going to be equal to 1. Yeah, no, that's a good question, because that wasn't obvious. I was kind of extrapolating from the previous ratio, but you're right, that if you throw in the nuisance parameters, it's not at all trivial that it works, but it does. Okay. Okay, so like I say, we can use lambda, or equivalently Q mu, which is just minus 2 log lambda, as this numerical measure of the level of agreement between the data and the hypothesized value of mu. And so what we want to do then is to quantify the level of agreement found by giving what we call the p-value. And so the p-value of a hypothesis is the probability to find data with less compatibility or equal compatibility with mu relative to the level of compatibility that you got with the data that you observed. Right? That's kind of a complicated sentence to say. But if you think about it in terms of a chi-squared-like variable, it's the probability, assuming mu, to get a chi-squared as high as the one you got or higher. Right? So in this case, it's the probability, the p-value of mu is the probability, under the assumption of mu, to get a value of q mu at least as great as the one that you actually observed, or higher. So that is simply the integral from q mu that you observed up to infinity of the distribution of q mu given mu. Right? So in order to calculate this probability, I would need to know the distribution of this statistic q mu, assuming that the true value were mu. That is to say, if I were to generate data in a Monte Carlo program, always using the hypothesized value mu for generating the data. Right. Now, I can write that. By the way, what is that? The integral from q mu observed to infinity is just 1 minus the integral from 0 to q mu observed. And that's what we call the cumulative distribution. And so I can write that as 1 minus the cumulative distribution of this statistic. Now, here is the little piece of magic, and that is the following. It turns out that this distribution of this statistic very rapidly approaches a chi-squared distribution. And that is a consequence of what is called Wilk's theorem. What Wilk's theorem says is that the distribution of minus 2 times the log of the likelihood ratio approaches a chi-squared distribution, provided that certain conditions are satisfied. And one of those conditions is that you have a large data sample. You have enough events. Now, we'll obviously have a finite number of events. And so it's not completely clear that this chi-squared PDF is an appropriate approximation. But Wilk's theorem is one of these things that where the large sample approximation kicks in very early, after maybe just a half a dozen events or some fairly small number of events. So this, in fact, by using a chi-squared distribution here, this is almost always an excellent approximation in practice. All right? And so the idea is that you get a certain p-value from the data that you got, and you would then reject the hypothesized value of mu if that p-value is less than or equal to the significance level of the test, which is 1 minus the confidence level of the limit that you're going to set. And so the set of mu values which are not rejected then form this confidence interval for mu. And I say approximate because the approximation is that we're using a chi-squared distribution for the sampling distribution of q mu. Now, I said that confidence intervals are constructed such that they are supposed to cover the true value of the parameter with a probability at least equal to the confidence level, at least equal to 1 minus gamma. And here, using this procedure, that is not quite true, but it is not true for all possible values of the nuisance parameter. But as long as the true value of the nuisance parameter is reasonably close to the value that you estimate, this coverage property is very close to being true. So it's the kind of thing, it's sufficiently accurate that I think the particle physics community is willing to put up with that level of approximation. And I believe this is the technique that people will most probably be pursuing for LHC analyses. Okay, so so that was the frequentist way of setting upper limits, including the way to do it when you have nuisance parameters. So now let me compare that with the Bayesian approach. So just to recap from yesterday, the idea in Bayesian statistics is that you have to start with some prior probability, what I'll call here pi of theta, which reflects the degree of belief about the parameters involved, theta, before doing the experiment. And what Bayes' theorem tells you is how your beliefs in theta should be updated after having seen the data, which I write here just as x symbolically. So it says the posterior probability for theta given x is proportional to the probability for x given theta, that's the likelihood function, times the prior. All right? And that the normalization constant just ensures that this is normalized to unit area if you integrate over all values of theta. Okay. So that function, that posterior probability, p of theta given x, that summarizes then all of your knowledge about theta in the light of the data. And so you can then say, well, all right, I can then simply integrate that posterior probability density between any limits, and that will give me my degree of belief that the parameter lies between those limits. So if the parameter that I'm interested in is this Poisson mean s, and the data is this number of events, then all I have to do is simply integrate the posterior p of s given n up to some upper limit such that the amount of probability contained is 95%. And that would then constitute my 95% confidence level upper limit from a Bayesian analysis. Sometimes instead of calling that a confidence interval, people call it a credible interval, because it's supposed to be a degree of belief interval, whereas the term confidence interval is used really in this technical sense of an interval which is designed to bracket the true value of the parameter with a pre-specified probability. It's not an interval which necessarily reflects your degree of belief. And we saw examples of that, right? For example, if the upper limit comes out negative, then your degree of belief that the parameter is contained below a negative number, if it's a Poisson mean, is zero, right? But nevertheless, that was the confidence interval. Okay? So one of the problems, of course, is that you have to specify a prior probability for the parameters involved. Now, if we're talking about the mean value of a Poisson distributed quantity, then of course it has to be positive. The mean number of events has to be positive. And you can incorporate that very easily into the prior simply by setting the prior of S equal to zero for negative S. All right, so that's a big advantage of the Bayesian procedure. You have no similar move that you can pull in the frequentist game. Right? But then what do you do about the prior for S for positive values of S? Well, one of the things that people often try to do is to set it equal to some constant for S greater than zero, or in any way, any case, you want it to be varying very slowly as a function of S. And so this constant prior is probably the most commonly applied, and I want to just point out some caveats with that. Yes, sorry, I'm talking of the same problem previously. So n is the number of events following a Poisson distribution. I'm assuming that the mean value of n will be some contribution from signal S and some contribution from background B. All right? But what I'm interested in is making inference about S. Right? So the first thing, I think we commented on this already yesterday, and that is that this density, as I've defined it here, cannot be normalized because if you integrate it, it diverges, obviously. Now, that's okay, usually, because the prior always enters in the product with, enters multiplied by the likelihood. And so as long as the likelihood falls off sufficiently quickly for large S, then that's not a problem. The posterior density will be integrable. All right? Another problem, which I think we also mentioned yesterday, is that this prior is not invariant under a change of parameter. So, for example, if you had taken not S as the relevant parameter, but log S, or e to the S, or S squared, or, for example, instead of using the expected number of Higgs events as your parameter, if you had used the Higgs mass as your parameter, then a flat prior in S would imply a non-flat prior in any of those other nonlinear functions of S. So you would have a non-flat prior for the Higgs mass, say. Right? Now, if what you want to say is that really reflects your degree of belief about S, then of course when you translate to something like log S or some nonlinear function, well, that new function should, in principle, reflect your degree of belief about log S. Right? And as long as the original and transformed functions both reflect your degree of belief, well, that's fine. But the problem is that when you wrote this down, think about it, that doesn't really represent a reasonable degree of belief about where the parameter should lie. This basically says that the probability that S is between 1 and 1.1 is the same as the probability that the parameter is between 1 million and 1 million.1. Or 10 to the hundredth and a 10 to the hundredth plus 0.1, all right? So that, and furthermore, you can say, look, the probability that S is less than any finite limit is zero, right, with this. So it doesn't really reflect a reasonable degree of belief, but nevertheless, it is used very often as a sort of point of reference, all right? You can also view this in the following way. If you construct an interval using that prior and this recipe, then it will have a certain probability to bracket the true value of the parameter, but that probability will depend on the true value of the parameter. That's in contrast to the confidence interval, where that coverage probability was to good approximation independent of the true value of the parameter. Nevertheless, you can investigate the frequentist properties of these Bayesian intervals, and what you find is that the coverage will depend on the true S. There is an entire school of Bayesian statistics that basically takes this as the important feature of what they do. That is to say, they use Bayes' theorem, but they don't interpret the probabilities as degrees of belief. They simply use a Bayesian analysis as a mechanism to construct intervals, and then they investigate the frequentist properties of those intervals. They investigate, for example, the probability that those intervals will cover the parameters in question. And that's usually called the objective Bayesian school. And people argue as to whether or not that's an appropriate name, but it's not using probability as a subjective degree of belief. So they call it the objective Bayesian school. Yes? Sorry,
Is it possible to take an average?
Of what?
Over all the possible pi of s.
There are many different, there's an infinity of different pi of s's that you can write down,
yeah.
And I don't know how you would define an average. You'd have to, well, I don't know exactly how you would do that. That seems not to be really perfectly well defined. There are different types of arguments that you can bring in to choose different priors. I don't want to push this as the best one, but all of the priors that people have proposed for this problem have problems of one sort or another, and this is at least a prior which people have very often applied, so I wanted to mention it. There is a prior called the Jeffries prior, which in this case would go as 1 over s, that would give you an answer which would be independent among certain transformations of the parameter. But those have other problems, so I'm not sure I want to go into that. This whole question of how to choose the prior, I think, is a difficult one. It doesn't have a simple solution. If I think of a better answer to that, I'll let you. Okay, so if you use that constant prior, and you plug that into Bayes' theorem, and then you solve that upper limit of integration for your upper limit, you then get the following upper limits. There is then the upper limit in S as a function of the expected background shown for different numbers of observed events, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. And interestingly here, what you see is that your upper limit on S, if you observe 0 events, doesn't depend on the expected background. And this is sort of a philosophical point that's generated a certain amount of debate. If you recall in the curve from the frequentist recipe, the upper limit on S that you set, let me find it, suppose you observe 0 events, but you say, well, but I expected a lot of background, say 2 events background or 3 events background, then the limit that you set is actually lower. Right, because somehow you observed even less than what you expected to find there from background. Now that's a little silly, because if you think about it, suppose you observe 0 events. How many background events could possibly have been in your data sample? 0. It had to have been 0 background events. And so therefore, the expected amount of background is irrelevant to any inference that you might want to make about the signal. Right? And so from a strict philosophical point, the Bayesians would say, look at what the silly frequentists are doing. They're making inference on S, which depends on the expected background, even in cases where they know that there was no background present. Right? Whereas in the Bayesian case, it has this nice feature that the upper limit on S is independent of the expected background, in that case where you know that no background was present because you observed 0 events. I should note one other numerical coincidence, and that is the following, is that if the expected background is 0, then the upper limit that you get from the Bayesian method happens to coincide exactly, numerically, with the upper limit that you would get from the frequentist method that I showed. And that really has to be regarded as a coincidence, because it wouldn't be true if you had taken a flat prior in log S or S squared. But it happens to be the case if you take a flat prior in S. Okay, let's keep going.
Sorry, just a quick question.
Yeah.
On the group I's, the new X.
sorry, so I wrote it here as new S up, but that's S up. It's the upper limit on S. So it's the number that you would get by solving that integral. Okay. Yeah, sorry, I changed my notation midstream there. Okay. Now, that was for the case when the expected background was assumed to be known with no uncertainty. But suppose you want to take account of the fact that there is some uncertainty in the expected background. So that means that I have now two parameters, S and B. So B enters now as a nuisance parameter. And I need to write down a prior density for both parameters. And again, I have to ask myself, are the two parameters independent or not? If they are, I could write the prior for both as the product of a function of S times a function of B. And if that's not the case, I have to include the correlations as appropriate. But let's assume for the moment that my uncertainty on B has nothing to do with my uncertainty on S, so that I can factorize that in this way. Now, for the prior on S, I can choose that however I'd like. And I can use this conventional prior of a constant, or I can try one of the other priors that people have mentioned, such as this 1 over S thing that I mentioned. That's the controversial part, right? That's the place where there is a lot of heated discussion. But what do I choose for my prior about B? Well, the idea of this prior is that it is a function which is supposed to reflect my degree of belief about where B lies. And so if what I had was a measured value of B, and I say that that represents a measurement with a certain standard deviation sigma B, then an appropriate prior could be a Gaussian function. But as we discussed yesterday, there's this whole error on the error discussion, which indicated that perhaps a Gaussian distribution is not always the most appropriate prior for a parameter. So you put whatever is deemed to be appropriate to reflect your degree of belief about where the nuisance parameter B could lie. And you put those ingredients then into Bayes' theorem. You get that the posterior density for S and B, given the measured value of N, is proportional to the likelihood function, which is just the Poisson probability law, times the prior, which is whatever you choose is appropriate for the prior. And then you are only interested in the parameter S. And so what do? You integrate that posterior density over the nuisance parameters. And you can do that in this particular case. Can I do it in closed form? Well, you can at least do it using the Markov chain Monte Carlo methods that I mentioned yesterday. And then once you have the posterior density for S given N, you can simply integrate that from 0 up to some limit S up such that the area contained is 95%. And that would give you your upper limit. Now, the controversial part here is still deciding what to use for the prior for the signal. The treatment of the nuisance parameter is, in some sense, straightforward. I said here easy. I shouldn't have said easy, because it's maybe not easy to decide what is the appropriate prior. But it is the prior which is at least not supposed to be some reference prior or an uninformative prior. This prior is supposed to represent your degree of belief as to where the nuisance parameter B lies. Okay, so that is what I wanted to say about limits. How am I doing for time? I've been going 40 minutes, is that right? Okay. So that was limits. That was a large part of the discussion that we had during the LEP program, because at LEP we unfortunately didn't discover anything new. We only set limits. And the hope is that at the LHC we're going to focus much less on setting limits and focus a lot more on actually making discoveries. So I now want to talk about how one goes about convincing your public that the signal you think you have observed is statistically significant. And we'll start with the frequentist approach to that. And so suppose what you want to try to discover is the Higgs. And so what you would like to do, therefore, is to reject the hypothesis of background only. Reject the hypothesis that there is no Higgs. And so what you do is you define a statistic, a quantity, which I'll call here T, whose value reflects the compatibility of the data to this background only hypothesis. And you compute the p-value. So actually, I introduced this p-value already earlier in connection with the limits. So that's the probability to have less than or equal compatibility with the hypothesis in question relative to the data obtained, assuming that hypothesis is correct. And so, for example, if t is like a chi-squared-like quantity, such that high values mean less compatibility, then this p-value would simply be the integral from t to infinity of the sampling distribution of that statistic under the assumption of the hypothesis being tested. And if that p-value comes out very small, that means that there would be only a very small probability to get data as incompatible as you got, or even more so. And so that is taken as evidence that that hypothesis, therefore, is probably wrong. And that means that you've made your discovery. If you reject the background-only hypothesis, then you're effectively saying that you think that some other new signal process must have contributed. All right. Now, very often when we're talking about discoveries, it's not the p-value itself, numerically, which gets reported, but rather an equivalent number, which doesn't really have a name, but people have called it the significance or the equivalent Gaussian significance. And we started using the letter Z to represent that. It's absolutely equivalent to the p-value. It's just another way of reporting the same number. And what you do is the following, is you consider a Gaussian distribution, right, with some standard deviation sigma, and you say, how many standard deviations would you have to go in one direction from the mean in order to have the upper tail area there equal to p, equal to the p-value? Right? So you can see that there's just a one-to-one mapping from this quantity z onto the p-value p. Right? It's just the p is equal to the integral from z to infinity of a Gaussian distribution of unit width. Right? Here I've used the letter capital phi to denote the cumulative distribution of a Gaussian. And so that then is the formula. P is 1 minus the cumulative distribution of Z, or you can invert that in that way. And those are the root functions that you can use to translate back and forth between the two. Right? So, all right, how low should your p-value be before you decide that you actually want to reject the hypothesis in question? Well, the folklore in particle physics for many years has been to say that you regard a discovery as worthy of the name discovery, right, when the p-value goes below 2.9 times 10 to the minus 7. Right? That corresponds to a five standard deviation effect, a Gaussian significance of 5, a 5 sigma effect. Now, the fact that I use here folklore in the sort of pejorative sense, because I don't really like sticking to this convention, the actual p-value at which you become convinced that your discovery is real should depend on other factors as well. It should depend, for example, on the plausibility of the proposed signal. Now, an example would be, if you recall the D0, D0 bar mixing. This was discovered just a few years ago. The Babar and Bell experiments saw evidence for this. Now, it was expected in the standard model. There were many uncertainties as to the rate, but nevertheless, it was expected that this process would exist, and it was entirely plausible that it would be observed by the Babar and Bell experiments. And so nobody thought it particularly necessary to have such a low p-value before you actually announced and became convinced that this process actually existed. And in fact, I believe the p-value when they announced the discovery was more like 0.02 or 0.03. So if the thing that you're observing, you're pretty sure that it's there anyway, there's no particular reason to doubt its existence until you get such a fantastically low p-value. Now, for something like the Higgs boson, I think the community is happy with the threshold p-value on the order of 10 to the minus 7. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that our prior degree of belief in the existence of the Higgs boson is low. Actually, I think for most people in the room, most people are probably pretty convinced that the Higgs really does exist. But because it's such an important discovery, we regard the burden of proof should be very, very high, very heavy burden of proof. And so therefore, having a 5 sigma effect before you announce the discovery of the Higgs is considered reasonable. Some of you may recall or may not recall, depending on how old you are, a number of years ago, there was a meteorite that was found in Antarctica that people determined came from Mars, and they found some little bug-like creatures in it, and people started to look at this and think that there was perhaps evidence of life on Mars. And the point was made that because that is such a fantastic claim, you should have a very high level of significance. There should be a very high, heavy burden of proof. I don't know if that's an appropriate p-value or not. And you can imagine that as the claim gets more and more fantastical, you should require increasingly high degree of evidence before you start to believe it. Now, suppose you did an experiment for astrology and you had a p-value of 10 to the minus 20. Would that really convince you that astrology was true? It is not only your prior degree of belief in the process which is relevant. It's also your degree of trust in the model involved. Suppose there was some just Poisson law which led to you have expected background of 2.5 and you observed 30 events. Right, that might be, in fact, something like 10 to the minus 20, exceedingly low p-value. But if the proposed signal was just so implausible, then you would start to question the model involved. So there are many other factors that I think have to come into evaluating whether or not you really think a discovery is there other than just this raw p-value. All right.
Yeah. We have to see other things.
All right. So we do an experiment for ESP or astrology or whatever, and the p-value comes out 10 to the minus 20. You know, some guy says, I can guess what card you're going to pull out of a deck of cards, and he does 20 of them straight. The p-value might be exceedingly small, but then I'll start to think, maybe it's a trick deck of cards. Maybe the model that I am applying to that situation is simply incorrect. And actually, very often, I think this happens in particle physics, that you'll see some effect which is statistically significant. There's no question that it's statistically significant. But the discussion will revolve around whether or not there is some systematic effect present which could be mimicking the signal, which hasn't been taken into account. Right. So very often, these numbers start to become irrelevant. And it's not so much what is the p-value, but it's do you or do you not trust the model that was used to derive the p-value. Okay, so that is the way that it's been done in particle physics. That is to say, we will quote a certain number of significant of standard deviations for an effect. And you might ask, well, all right, that's a frequentist construct. That's based on a p-value. How do you do that in the Bayesian context? And the Bayesian equivalent of a p-value is something which has not received much attention in particle physics. And so I want to discuss that and just propose that as a possible alternative or a possible complement to the p-value-based approach. So this is what goes under the name of Bayesian model selection. Now, the idea here is that what you would really like to do in a Bayesian analysis is to compute the probability of the hypothesis in question. And you would like to compare that to the probability of some alternative. So suppose I have two hypotheses. H0 could be the background-only hypothesis, and H1, its alternative, could be the hypothesis that the Higgs is also present in my data. Right? And what I would like to do is to compare the probability for the no Higgs hypothesis, given the data, to the probability for the Higgs hypothesis, given the data. All right, that's what I would call the posterior odds ratio. Right? The odds is then the ratio of these two probabilities. And if that ratio comes out small, then I would say that the no Higgs hypothesis is disfavored. Okay? Now, Bayes' theorem tells us that this posterior probability, P of H0 given X, is proportional to P of X given H0 times the prior for H0. And then similarly, the numerator has the same proportionality, and the proportionality constant is the same for both. So therefore, it cancels in the ratio. All right, so therefore, I can write the posterior odds as equal to the ratio of these two likelihoods times the ratio of priors. And it is that ratio of likelihoods which is called the Bayes factor. All right? In the simple case, when there are no nuisance parameters, it is just equal to the likelihood ratio. And this Bayes factor is what is used in order to quantify your degree of belief that the data favor H1 over H0, or vice versa. It is regarded as a measure of the weight of the evidence of the data of one hypothesis over the other. All right. So sometimes this is written with two indices to indicate the hypotheses in question. You know, this would be B01, or you could call it B10 if you had the indices the other way around. Okay, and so if you look in the Bayesian literature, there is a discussion about what is an appropriate value for the Bayes factor in order to think that you've really made a discovery. I got this from a paper by Cass and Raftery as to what Bayes factor they would regard as being appropriate evidence or meaningful evidence against the null hypothesis. So, you know, they say 1 to 3, not worth a beer mention, you know, 150 strong and so forth. But remember that this is what the posterior odds ratio would be if the prior odds ratio were equal. All right, if you had no preference for one model over the other a priori, this is then what the posterior odds ratio would be. It could be, for example, that your prior odds ratio was 1 to 1,000,000 stacked against one of the hypotheses, in which case the Bayes factor then would not be, you know, this scale would not be appropriate. Now, I don't know if these Bayes factors will be adopted in particle physics, but I want to make the case that they should at least be attempted. But before we can do that, we have to be able to compute the Bayes factor, and that turns out to be a bit of a problem, so I want to get to that in just a second. All right. So let me just rewrite the Bayes factors in a very simple way. Suppose you have some models, some hypotheses, H sub I, where I is just an index that labels the hypothesis, and each predicts some probability law for the data that we're going to observe. Each predicts a probability of X given the hypothesis HI, and suppose that this ith model contains some internal parameters, theta sub I. All right, so this is the likelihood that one would have to write down. The Higgs model, for example, has a certain number of parameters, a Higgs mass, all the other standard model parameters. All right. And then furthermore, I need to specify a prior PDF for these internal parameters. All right? That is to say, the full prior for this model is equal to the overall prior probability of the model times a prior density for its parameters. All right? And this can be a separate density for each of the models in question. All right? That coefficient there, the PI, that's what I would call just P of HI with no parameters. It's the overall prior probability for the model in question. The probability that that model is true for at least one point in its parameter space. All right. So then I can rewrite the Bayes factor in the following way. Remember, it was the ratio of the likelihoods, and so that can be written as the ratio of the posterior to prior probability ratio for model I divided by the posterior to prior ratio probability ratio for model J. All right, so I've just rewritten the Bayes factor in that way. So what I need now are these quantities. So let me concentrate on P of HI given the data. Let's see how I can rewrite that. So what is that? What Bayes' theorem gives me is not P of HI, but the joint probability P of HI and theta. Right? And so what I need to do then is to marginalize that over the internal parameters. So I need to integrate this thing over the theta I. All right. So let me now just take that posterior density, P of HI theta given X, and rewrite that integrand using Bayes' theorem. All right. So that is equal to the probability of X given HI theta I, that's the likelihood, times the prior. And the prior, recall, is then the total probability for the ith hypothesis times the density for its internal parameters, and then you divide by the probability of the data, X. All right? And so that is the P of HI given X. And I can do that for both model I and model J. And when you do so, and take their ratio, this P of X cancels. And then furthermore, what you have is if you look here, let me go back one. You will get a small pi in the numerator, and that is small pi in the denominator. All right. So what I want in this Bayes factor is the posterior divided by the prior for both models. And so what that means is that factor there, that little p sub I, is going to cancel. All right. It goes away. And so the desired Bayes factor is simply given by this expression here. What I have in both the numerator and the denominator is the integral of the likelihood times the prior. All right? And that is what's called the marginal likelihood. So the Bayes factor is given by the ratio of marginal likelihoods. All right? The overall prior probability for the model disappeared. Right? But what you still need to specify are the prior probability densities for the internal parameters of each model. And then you have to do this integral. Yeah.
In denominator P of X, what is it?
Say again, which is?
At the denominator P of X.
Okay, so from Bayes' theorem, remember it said that the probability of H given X, the probability of H and theta given X is equal to the probability of X given H and theta times the prior probability of H and theta divided by the probability of X. That's just Bayes' theorem. But you get one of these P of X's in the numerator, and you get another P of X in the denominator, and so they go away. So just to reiterate this point, the Bayes factor does not depend on the overall prior probabilities for the models, but it does depend on the prior probabilities for the internal parameters of each model. Okay, so for both numerator and denominator, I have to do an integral of that form. And I'm running out of time, so I'm not going to discuss that. But this turns out to be very difficult. And you thought, but wait, you just told us about this marvelous Markov chain Monte Carlo technique. Surely that can somehow be employed to give you these Bayes factors. And it's just not so easy. There are methods for trying to calculate Bayes factors and marginal likelihoods based on sampling from the posterior density using MCMC, but it is not such a simple story. I have some extra slides that I've included at the back of the talk that talk about that a little bit, and there is an interesting reference. But here are some of the methods that people have proposed, and there is certainly no general recipe, and it's the kind of thing that you have to develop a recipe for each different problem. Okay, so I have just a few minutes. Can I do one final example, and then we finish? Over the last year or so in Atlas, we have been planning a combination of the search results for the Higgs using the different decay modes of the Higgs, right? So if we find the Higgs, it won't just be in one of the different decay modes, but we will be looking for it in many different decay modes. Depending on the mass of the Higgs, it could turn out that a combination of all of those channels is what is crucial in order to establish the discovery. Furthermore, both Atlas and CMS were very keen to develop the statistical tools to combine Atlas and CMS results so as to be able to see if both experiments together would have a significant discovery. So I think that the competition between LHC and the Tevatron was one of the factors driving that. And so here is a reference of a nice exercise that is part of this humongous tome produced by the Atlas collaboration, referred to internally as the CSC book, but there is its reference. This particular study is, I think, on page 1,480-something of this document. Maybe don't download the whole thing. And what we did in order to establish the expected discovery significance or expected limits was this profile likelihood method for the systematic uncertainties. And so I'd just like to flash that quickly as an example of one of the methods that I just illustrated. The idea here is that when you're looking for the Higgs, you don't simply count the number of candidate events, but for every candidate event, you measure some number of quantities. And of course, one of the quantities that you would measure is the invariant mass of the Higgs candidate. All right, so if the Higgs goes to gamma-gamma, you record for every candidate event the invariant mass of the two-photon system. And if the Higgs really exists, then you should see a bump in the two-photon mass distribution. Now, so suppose I have for every candidate, for every decay channel, a histogram. And that histogram represents the measurement of the distribution of this kinematic variable. And so the expectation value of the number of entries in the ith bin can be written in the following form. There will be a certain contribution from background events, that is to say non-Higgs events. And then there is a certain expectation for the number of signal events that should be present if the standard model is correct. And what we did is we multiplied that expectation by a strength parameter that we called mu. The idea being that the mu equals zero hypothesis is the background-only hypothesis. And the mu equals one hypothesis says that you have something like a Higgs boson at the standard model strength. But you could also consider a model which had a Higgs-like object, but with a rate which is different from the standard model rate. Okay, so that would be a mu value different from one. Okay. So how do you get these values SI and BI, the expected number of signal and background events in each bin, the ith bin? Well, of course, there will be some total number of signal events predicted times some probability to be in the ith bin. And that probability to be in the ith bin of some kinematic variable x will be obtained by, you know, predicting the distribution of that variable and then integrating it over that bin. And those distributions, you know, the shape of the mass distribution for, I don't know, Higgs goes to gamma-gamma or Higgs goes to four leptons, that will have some complicated shape. It will depend on some number of shape parameters. So here I've used the letters theta s and theta b to represent the parameters which determine the shape of those distributions. So those enter into the nuisance parameters. Also, the total amount of background in principle is something that we should be able to predict. We could just run Pythia and predict the total number of background events. But that prediction would not be sufficiently accurate to be usable. You need a much more accurate prediction. And so what we always do for all of these channels is to try to set up some subsidiary measurement which constrains the expected background. And so we're going to treat here the total background parameter, total number of background events, also as a nuisance parameter that needs to be constrained by some other measurement. All right, so we write down some complicated likelihood function. The likelihood function contains the one parameter of interest, mu. And here I've written simply as theta. Theta symbolically represents all of the nuisance parameters. So the shape parameters for background, the shape parameters for signal, the total background, and any other parameters that have to enter into the problem. So this product of Poisson probability terms here, that represents the likelihood from the what you would call the search region. But then you might also have additional measurements from control samples that constrain the nuisance parameters. So then that term there represents the contribution to the likelihood function from those subsidiary measurements. Okay, so your likelihood function would be of that form. It would contain a parameter of interest and some vector of nuisance parameters. That would be for one channel. That would be, say, for Higgs to gamma gamma. And then if you had some number of channels, then each channel would have a likelihood function, Li of mu, and its own set of nuisance parameters, theta I. But what we have assumed in this exercise is that this strength parameter, mu, is common to all of the channels. Which is to say that if a Higgs boson exists, we're assuming that it contributes to all of these decay channels with branching ratios as specified by the standard model. So that means that the full likelihood function is simply the product of those individual likelihood functions. Okay, that because the selected events for each channel are separate events. Right? And so then we built this profile likelihood ratio quantity. Right? We equivalently used the... by the way, this page is not in your handouts, I apologize. Or is it? I stuck in some extra slides at the last minute, so you may or may not see this one. We equivalently use minus 2 log of this likelihood ratio to quantify the level of agreement between the observed data and the hypothesized value of the strength parameter mu. Right? And for technical reasons that I don't have time to go into here, the conditions which were necessary in order for Wilk's theorem to be satisfied were not exactly satisfied in our problem. And that means that the sampling distribution of this statistic was not just a chi-square distribution, but it is half the events with a chi-square distribution, and then a delta function at zero, also with half weight. So the sampling distribution was related to a chi-square distribution, but it was not simply equal to a chi-square distribution, as I had stated a few transparencies previously. If you need to know the details about why that is, I have to refer you to page 1480-something of that big note. But the important point is that we can write down a formula for the sampling distribution of this test variable. And so therefore, we can compute a p-value. That is to say that the sampling distribution for q mu given mu would have some form which is related to a chi-square distribution, and it has a spike at zero as well. We would then do the experiment and get a certain value for q mu. There would be an observed value. And then the probability to see a value that high or higher would be the p-value. And if that p-value is then less than 2.9 times 10 to the minus 7, you would then reject the hypothesis of mu. All right? Now, in order to characterize the sensitivity of the experiment, we were not interested in the significance with which you would reject a certain mu for a given data set, but we wanted to know, for example, suppose the Higgs exists at the standard model rate, all right, with what significance should we expect to reject the background-only hypothesis? That's how we want to characterize how good our experiment is. So we want to say, suppose the Higgs does exist, all right, what kind of discovery significance would you expect? And so if you consider a value of mu which is different from the hypothesized mu, then you would expect a sampling distribution which is higher. And so what we did is the following. Is that for discovery, what we did is we would generate data under the mu equals 1 hypothesis and give the median value of the discovery significance when testing the background-only hypothesis. And for exclusion, what we would do is we generate data under the background-only hypothesis, and we test the hypothesis of the standard model. And we look and see what the limits we would be able to set on the, you know, what set of mu values would we expect to have p-values less than 0.05, if that were true. All right. So, again, I want to emphasize that we had lots of nuisance parameters in this problem, and these were treated by using the profile likelihood method, and we were quite happy with how that worked. And so here's just, I'll flash a quick result. Here is then the expected discovery significance. This is this quantity Z, but it's not the Z from any specific data set. It's the expectation value of Z that you would have if the data contains Higgs bosons at the standard model rate. And that is as a function of the hypothesized Higgs mass. And the curves underneath are from the individual Higgs channels. And then the curve on top is what you get if you combine the information from all of the channels. And so you can see here, this is from 10 inverse femtobarns, and you can see that we're over this 5 sigma discovery threshold for masses greater than 120-something, 128.7. But the actual numbers are not so important here. This was just an exercise, because this exercise did not take into account all of the channels that we will eventually use. This color plot just shows the same thing in a slightly more complicated way. It's the luminosity versus the Higgs mass. The luminosity required to get a discovery significance of a certain level versus the Higgs mass. And so here's the analogous set of plots for exclusion. This is the expected p-value of the mu equals 1 hypothesis versus the Higgs mass. And so if that drops below 0.05, you would say that the corresponding Higgs mass is excluded. So that would be then your limit on the Higgs mass. And again, so those are the contributions from the individual decay channels, and then the dark curve is from the combination. Okay, so let me wrap up. So different sorts of limits answer different values of questions. So the frequentist confidence interval, remember, is designed so as to cover the true value with a particular probability, but it does not necessarily answer the question, where do you believe the true value of the parameter really lies? It's important to look at the expected limits and also consider other things, such as the need for conventions and the convenience and the ability to combine results. Now, Bayesian limits can also be used. They then would directly address this question as to the degree of belief of the parameter, but only if the prior probabilities that you insert reflect a corresponding degree of belief. Now, regardless of how you do it, I think that the consumer will always compute, mentally or otherwise, you've given some result, maybe a confidence interval, maybe a p-value, maybe a Bayesian interval. And the point is that the person who reads your paper is always then going to say, well, gee, given what he's written, do I think that the Higgs exists or not? And the way that thinking process takes place always involves a sort of Bayesian reasoning, all right? And the consumer will insert his or her own prior belief as to whether or not supersymmetric technispreons are plausible or not. Okay, so on discovery, we have this current convention of using p-values, or equivalently, the number of standard deviations, and this discovery threshold is really quite low, and should depend on other factors as well. It should depend on the plausibility of the signal and the confidence in the modeling of the background. I think these Bayes factors will also provide an important complementary piece of information, and they should hopefully point to the same conclusion as the p-value. And this is one of the things that we're pushing in both the Atlas and CMS, I think, are headed in this direction, that we would like to report as many results as possible using both a frequentist analysis and a Bayesian analysis. If they lead to the same conclusion, then great, that increases our confidence. If they don't lead to the same conclusion, then we have to understand why, and then you learn something. So I think that using both Bayes factors and p-values is what I would expect to look out for. Okay, so I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thanks, Glenn, for enabling us to potentially extract the Higgs with all the caveats.
Yeah?
So then our significance level is not, like, it will not be with 5 sigma.
If the Higgs mass is very low,
yes.
Then with 10 inverse femtobarns of data, even if the Higgs exists, we would not expect to have a discovery significance above psi 5 sigma. That's correct.
But we need more luminosity.
You either need more luminosity or you need to combine additional channels, which I have not indicated here. All right, so there are perhaps some other channels that might give you additional sensitivity for very low Higgs masses. So TTH, for example, which is not ready yet for this exercise.
So in defining the Bayes factor, you have this ratio of prior odds for the null hypothesis and its complement.
Right.
And it's not, obviously, when you'd be justified in setting that ratio to be anything.
No, it's an if-then statement. I'm saying if that ratio were to be 1, then the Bayes factor is equal to what the posterior odds. So really, it's got to be taken with that understanding. The Bayes factor, suppose you really had a very different prior probabilities for the two hypotheses in question. The Bayes factor simply says, based only on the evidence, does it point more to hypothesis I or hypothesis J? So really, the Bayes factor just tells you what the posterior odds would be if the prior odds were to be equal to 1. Nobody's saying that you have to actually think that the prior odds are equal to 1.
So, Glenn, the support using mu to parametrize the Higgs cross section in a certain sense is really not dissimilar from the amplitude scans.
That's right. Can't recall exactly how that plot went.
So in the amplitude,
it's like you would make an estimate of mu with an error bar, for example, as a function of.
As a function of MH.
Ah, that's a good question. We haven't actually looked at that plot, but you're absolutely right. We could do that. Yeah. What we've really only looked at is for each value of MH to look at what the expected significance would be to reject the given value of mu. But we could actually look at, because obviously you could try to estimate mu for different, and what you would find, presumably, is that if MH is the wrong mass.
Well, because the different channels have different sensitivity as a function of MH, but none of them has, short of gamma gamma maybe, which has extremely good resolution, all the others have some plot.
It's quite broad, yeah.
Measured MH very well. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so what you would in principle see in this distribution the shape of the contribution from each channel.
Okay, that's interesting.
And that would give you maybe a handle on systematics which you may not have.
That's an interesting suggestion. Yeah, we should think about that. Let me go back to the very beginning.
Oh, yeah.
So I was just... that was just somehow to motivate the discussion that, suppose the expected background is 4.6, right? And you observe 20 events. Well, then you wouldn't be thinking about limits. You would simply say, well, if the expected background is 4.6 and I saw 20, then my expected number of signals should be the difference between the two, and I would make my measurement. There would be no question in that case that the signal process must be present in the data. But what I wanted to say is the following, is that suppose that you don't know whether or not the signal process exists at all, and the number of observed events was not too much bigger, and perhaps even less, than the expected number of background events. In that case, the way that you would like to characterize the outcome of your experiment is to set an upper limit on the expected number of signal events. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but that was the whole reason why
how should I interpret that the limit is between 0 and 0.5 of an event? Is there any...
That wasn't the limit in that case. In order to know what the limit would be, with B equals 4.6 and 5 events, we need to go to this plot here, and it says, so there's the curve, that would be my upper limit if I observe 5 events, and if B is equal to 4.6, then that would be my limit, and it would be, you know, whatever that is. It looks like 5.5. That would be the limit that I would get from this first procedure, and then the Bayesian procedure would give you a different limit, and these different procedures would all give slightly different limits. The slides in the web are now complete, and they're on my website, but not on your website. So we will get those ported into the school's website. Maybe it's best that I make whatever tweaks I'm going to make to tomorrow's lecture first, but I think it's pretty stable, so we can do that now, actually. So apologies, for the last minute tweaks.
Thank you. Bye again. If you haven't gotten the feedback, we're not expecting that.